London Unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Good evening and welcome to The Big Picture. Welcome back after Easter. We hope you had a great break. Thank you for joining us this evening. We'll be discussing David Cameron's comments about Britain being a Christian country. We'll be talking about the British public's view on torture. And we'll be looking at the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. I'm your presenter, Matthew, for this evening. Thank you for joining us. We'll introduce our panel. So we have...
Good evening. My name's David Hayes. I am a PhD reading criminal justice.
Evening all. This is Joseph Himsworth. I'm a first-year history student.
And I'm Seb Bench. I'm a second-year politics student.
And he doesn't wish you a good evening at all.
We all do, of course. We all do. We're very happy in this exam period. We love exams.
Woo!
Said no one ever.
I'm a PhD. I don't have exams.
Oh, lucky you. Lucky you. I'm sure you've had a lot of work, nonetheless. Well, we'll begin by David Cameron's comments about the Britain of today being a Christian country. A letter of 50 signatories wrote to the Daily Telegraph saying that David Cameron risks causing what they call alienation in society by saying Britain is a Christian country. The Prime Minister said that the UK should be more confident about its Christianity, a view number 10 says he has stated before. Faith leaders have said that they are very comfortable with Mr. Cameron's views, but it has sparked some controversy. Human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell told BBC Radio 4's Today programme the assertion Britain is a Christian country was not factually accurate. He cited a YouGov poll of saying 65% of people questioned described themselves as quote-unquote not religious, while 29% said they were. He argues that those people who have come from a range of faiths, not just Christianity. So, my question to the panel, do we think that the modern Britain of today is a Christian country? David.
I'd have to agree with the controversy on this. I think Britain is a country with a Christian history. It's a Britain with a Christian head of state, but that doesn't make the country itself Christian. And I think that's what we need to unpick here is what exactly does it mean to be a Christian country and what exactly does it mean to what exactly are the consequences are that for our politics, for our culture, for our society? And I think when we talk about whether or not we're a Christian country, I think it's a question of whether our day-to-day life, our day-to-day moral decisions and our political consciousness are shaped by Christian morals, Christian virtues and Christian duties. And I think that hasn't been the case for at least the past 50, 60 years and is growing the case. And, you know, just statement of interest here, but I consider myself an apatheist, which is to say I'm somebody who believes that the existence or non-existence of God postulates nothing about morality and, you know, how we should live our lives. So for me, that's a pretty good state of affairs. But that's my opinion.
Seb?
I'd have to agree broadly with David. I mean, there are a lot of figures about, one by Pete Tatchell, you pointed to, Matt, by various groups, some suggesting that we were a Christian country, some not, in terms of kind of beliefs and church attendance. I think certainly it would seem, the majority seems that in general, if there is perhaps a majority who do believe in Christianity loosely, so then there isn't sort of an active practicing Christian body. But I think that's only half it. I mean, that's one of it. And I think saying that the Britain's a Christian country or not does go slightly beyond that, as we say, into the role it has in our government and its implications. And I think you'd have to say that political discourse in the UK really is not Christian in terms of, ironically, although we do have the established church, whereas the US obviously doesn't with the First Amendment, religion dominates political arguments far more in the US, whereas in the UK, really, there's no, very, very rarely, an appeal to God for morality. This is why we do it. It's very much a secular debate. And that's why I think it's fair to say that it's more of a secular country, not that it's specifically atheist or agnostic, but really there is less of the impact of religion and specific religion in making a decision. And that's good. And we have a fair and open society where Christians, atheists and any other faith people are free, I believe, to make their views. And I think that's the way it should stay.
Okay, Joe.
Yeah, I broadly agree with everyone else. I think it's a really difficult debate, actually, because it requires such nuance in sort of analysing what a Christian country actually means. Now, I broadly agree with David that there is a difference in what Christian country can mean in different contexts. Now, clearly, by Christian country, David Cameron doesn't mean sort of 17th century Salem, and nor does he mean sort of the United States. I think culturally, we're broadly Christian, just in the same sense that we're European. But on top of that, you've got the layer that since basically the 1950s, we've been a multicultural society. I wouldn't take on board particularly the comments of those 50 or so who wrote to the Telegraph. Peter Tatchell does my head in somewhat. But yeah, I think that, that broadly we've got the sort of edifices and paraphernalia of a Christian country. Her Majesty's both the head of state and defender of the faith. Lots of our holidays are based around sort of Christian events, Christian holidays. So I think it's really different, well, difficult, but broadly I'd say yes, broadly.
Okay. David, we'll go to you next.
I think it's worth remembering as well, maybe going back a little bit to Seb's point about the irony of the US separating out church and state. There's that brilliant clip of what's-her-face from the Tea Party, that's a technical term.
Sarah Palin.
Not Sarah Palin, although I'll come to her in a moment. Rachel or Rebecca somebody? Anyway, she was running for senator and she was in a debate with another Republican, I believe, and she asked where in the Constitution it said that there should be separation of church and state, which for those of you playing at home is the, you know, the very First Amendment. In any event, yeah, but recently it's interesting in that we've had two slightly nutty comments based on Christianity and Christian ethics from both sides of the channel. David Cameron saying that the big society is all part of Jesus's vision. And, you know, I don't think there's any part of the New Testament where Jesus went around taking away people's libraries and then blaming them when they didn't have any books. but that pales in comparison, haha. And here we come to Sarah Palin saying that Jesus was a strident advocate of the death penalty. let he who was without sin and all that.
So it's a bit different. It's a bit different here, obviously.
I think it's a very different cultural situation. I think America has been a lot more culturally Christian, even though the political apparatus isn't there. And I think broadly, I'd agree with the panel in that the cultural apparatus is very different here. It's very much secular, multicultural, and again, I think we can broadly celebrate that as a good thing.
Okay, I want to go back to you, Joe. I mean, don't the people from the who wrote to the Telegraph have a point? In that the 2011 census found that 4 million people, 4 million less people have described themselves as Christian in England and Wales from 2001. I mean, don't they have a point that, you know, this might isolate and alienate some people?
Well, I don't think it will particularly. I think that the UK is a very broad and tolerant country, and I think that most people who've come to this country, whether as immigrants at the present day or sort of, you know, decades ago, I think will vouch for that. But my problem with those 50 people, really, is their sort of very anti-theistic stance, really, which I think, whether they're right or not, completely couches the debate in this sort of very moralistic framework, where it's really more about religion than Christian culture. I don't think, though, the idea that it's going to alienate anyone at all. I'm of the belief that rather than the state altering to suit people who come here, people should broadly, although not entirely, of course, adapt to the country to which they come. But no, I don't think it's going to alienate people at all. I think I agree with Prince Charles, whether you agree with him or not, that actually having an established faith, he speaks to a lot of faith leaders, and it allows for room because people, in a sense, know their place. And now that sounds a bit derogatory, but I think it is beneficial, really.
David. I'm sorry, I thought we were I was under the impression that we lived in a democracy where the people controlled the state. I don't think that the fact that these 50 people were atheist, agnostic, anti-theistic, whatever you want to call it, has any real impact upon the merits or demerits of their arguments. Of course, it explains why they think that, because they don't want to live in a Christian country, because they don't think that that holds water. But I don't think that necessarily, you know, restricts the validity of their comments, which is that actually a large proportion of our society, I don't believe a majority, but a large proportion of society don't hold to the Christian faith, to any of the Christian faiths. I mean, and I think that's something that's worth bearing in mind. I'm usually the last person to go crying democracy, but I think it does have a big impact, you know, even with the limited forms of democracy we have in this country.
Seb.
Yeah, just like coming on the point David made about the big society and Christianity, and again with the US example where you get an awful lot of far conservatives are using religion to back up the arguments with a lot of arguments for cutting food stamps and a lot of arguments that a lot wouldn't see as Christian. I think that's a very interesting point, like Pope Francis, who's really led to a shift in at least the Catholic Church's message of the poor, and a much more positive and a view of the selfless view of, you know, helping the poor. And I think in that respect, obviously, Britain does have the establishment of the Church of England rather than the Catholic Church, but if that's part of what we say is being a Christian country, and as you said, it's actually very difficult to determine what you mean when you say a Christian country, then does that mean you have to say as a Christian country you take Pope Francis's, what he says, more into cues, and does that give his argument more merit, and does that make you hypocritical if you say it's a Christian country, but you then do policies that a great number would say are completely against the kind of teachings of Pope Francis? I think that's an interesting debate.
Is there a distinction here to be had between a Christian country and a Christian culture then? Joe, you wanted to say something first.
Yeah, I think there is. I completely respect David's argument and take that on board. I think that with respect to what you've said, Matt, yeah, there is. I think really the difficulty with this debate and what's actually happened in the papers is that we've got so bound up in actually having different debates between different people about what a Christian country is. And I think it's great that we've defined what we think of it. I think, yeah, when David says that people generally aren't Christian, I mean, that's been fluctuating hugely since about the 1500s, as has church attendance. I think it's declining. I think it'll continue to, unfortunately, in my opinion. But yeah, I think there needs to be a distinction drawn between a culture and the country, which takes on a lot more.
Okay, why do you feel it's a bad thing that church attendance is going down?
Well, I'm me myself being a Christian, I think without sounding sort of evangelical, I believe that to be the truth, and you know, without sort of forcing it on people, obviously that's not my intention whatsoever. But I think it's an admirable thing to have. I think it does have a part in community as well. So being a churchgoer myself, I sort of know about that. But I think if I can briefly get onto the point of the big society, which is going from this sort of community point. I mean, David Cameron, when he says this, it is just ridiculous. As David said, I mean, David is rather left-wing, in my opinion. But even I can agree that this is just absurd. I mean, the whole point of the Bible and Christianity broadly is that it's largely apolitical. You know, this is why people like Richard Dawkins annoy me when they say Christians think this. Well, a Christian like me is not going to say the same sort of thing as a Christian in, say, Nigeria. Mm. And so it's immensely broad. And for David Cameron to say that the big society is what Jesus preached, first and foremost, does anyone know what the big society is? I think not. And second of all, it's just skewing the whole... Well, it's skewing scripture, basically, and just interpreting something completely absurd out of it. And I think it can be quite dangerous.
Okay, we've had a text in. You can text in if you like, by the way. The number to do so is 07762-212-434, or you can send us a free web text on the website. This person texted in and said, Cameron only said that to appease the church and archbishop who are unhappy following the gay marriage legislation. I feel as if it was more appeasement to UKIP defectors, and he can't be naive enough to think that we can still call the UK a Christian country. What are our opinions on that, David?
I think there's definitely an element of that. I mean, a point that I was hoping to make sometime here is that you saw a similar thing from Tony Blair pulling the God card over the war in Iraq. You didn't see Gordon Brown do that. I think he would... I'm fairly sure he's Scottish Catholic. But
yeah, he's the son of a minister. Yeah.
He's the much more sort of quiet, faithful person that, you know, an apatheist like me can get on board with. You know, respectfully disagree, but you got your reasons. I will say that there is, I think, an element of David Cameron personally wanting to recognise Christian... elements in the way that we do government and the way we do politics here, if only because he himself is a Christian. He normally, you know, spins that out of his argument, and I don't think it's a massive part of who he is, but I don't know the guy. And it clearly is the case that he believes, you know, in the teachings of the Bible, and who am I to take that away from him? But it's I do think there's a large political edge here that he's trying to appeal to the conservative middle-class UKIP voter, and there's definitely an element of political spin going on there.
I mean, I want to go back to the timing of this because it's, you know, the government's been in power for 4 years now and it's suddenly come up. Do you think that the timing is a coincidence or is it planned, Seb?
I think that probably is planned, because, as you say, to kind of conserve part of the UKIP, rather than the church as a whole, but the voters perhaps may have been slightly turned off by gay marriage. So I think that's the point. Partly, I think going back to the point about whether, you know, culture and history is the same as being a Christian country, I think that's one of the problems. A lot of people, I think potentially that was part of the, a lot of people have been saying that's why we're a Christian country, whereas a lot of people do interpret that as saying actually, no, we Christian government and things like that. And that's one of the problems. It's very hard to define what you mean by a Christian country. For some people, that's those implications. Some, it doesn't. As a final point of the kind of big society and the point about saying God supports this and God supports that, there's very interesting debate, I think it must have been roughly a year ago, where saying a Lib Dem was partly, I think Greg Mulholland was partly culpable, saying God was a Lib Dem. And then there was the debate, I think Jacob Rees-Mogg says clearly he was God's a Somerset Conservative. And clearly, obviously, this whole debate is ridiculous. And then obviously you have to first argue whether God exists. But even if you say take a interpretation of the Bible, in saying he supports a particular party in a particular time is stretching it a bit and for anyone to do, I think.
Yeah, I think regarding David Cameron, I think it is planned, really. I think Downing Street have said that he's mentioned this before. He's barely mentioned this before. And if he has mentioned it before, it's not being of a political nature. So to sort of self-style what he said now into a narrative of what he said before is rather ridiculous, really. And also, I think that we'd have kind of seen it before in a way. I mean, I'm not going to judge David Cameron, you know, religiously. I'll judge him politically, of course. but it would have featured before in terms of what he thinks, how it sort of might shape his politics slightly. And for this sort of floodgate to open and all of a sudden burst out, I think is rather conspicuous, really.
And I think that's maybe the strongest argument you can make for British politics being Christian politics is that historical context, is that cultural context, that the institutions were formed around it, that our crest is still Dieu et mon droit, God and the right, that a lot of this culture and a lot of this history and a lot of the values which are now secularized have a Christian origin. I mean, you look at my field of research, probation. Probation started as an explicitly, or part of its origins anyway, in this country, was an explicit Christian missionary into prisons to stop people from offending because they were concerned about their souls. And that morphed over time into the broad social rehabilitation theory that they have nowadays. But it's a question of how far you take that. But, of course, the response to my own devil's advocate there is, of course, that these things crop up in all sorts of religion. I mean, the standard formal greeting farewell, rather, in Judaism is Ahavah Mashalom, love and peace, which is the sort of thing that tends to be emphasized by Islam, tends to be emphasized by Hinduism, Christianity, you know, that whole shebang.
Any other points? No? Okay.
I think that's fairly well covered.
Yeah. I mean, is it inappropriate or is it inaccurate to describe Britain as having just one culture? Or is it broader than that? What do we think? I mean, has that come across in his comments or is that not part of it, David?
I would say inappropriate is maybe going a little too far because, as I say, a lot of these values do cross religious and other cultural borders. And a lot of our core values are, if not explicitly Christian, then at least something that a Christian can get on board with. I think it's fair to say that Britain does have values. It's fair to try and have a debate about what those values are. But it's also important to recognize that where those values come from might not be a straight line that goes back to 2,500 years.
Seb?
I think it's a question, really, of how well and how far you think integration and multiculturalism has gone. I think if you think we have got the melting pot society, then many of us do want, and that succeeded, then we've got one culture which is a mix of others, then of a combination of others, then I think it is fair to say we're kind of one culture. But if you're saying we've got one culture in terms of we are one unifying Christian country, I think that's false. I think we are very much got a mix of cultures kind of melting at the moment, but we're a product of even more that have, you know, converged in the past.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much, panelists. We'll be back after the break. We're going to have a little quick song. We'll be discussing Britain's opinions on torture next and the 24 effect, how TV programmes have influenced the British people's perception of torture. Welcome back to The Big Picture. Thank you for joining us. And next we'll be discussing the 24 effect, what's been dubbed the 24 effect. A third of Britons now think that torture can be justified, according to quote-unquote alarming new research, which highlights how TV programmes such as 24 and Homeland have glamorised the abuse of detainees. The poll by Amnesty International found 36% of Britons believe torture is sometimes necessary and acceptable to gain information that may protect the public. That's a quote from the poll. Just 25% of Russians share the same view, although in China the figure is 74%. In addition, 44% of Britons reject the idea that there should be a global ban on torture. This is despite the fact that the UN has banned torture throughout the world since, well, over the past 30 years. which has been ratified by 155 countries. So what does the panel think about this? I mean, has torture been glorified by TV shows such as Homeland and 24 or not? David?
I think there's certainly got to be an element of that. I mean, in my own field, we talk about this sometimes in the context of criminal evidence. We talk about the CSI effect and how that's affected juries' willingness to pay a lot more attention to forensic evidence and to not recognize that it isn't actually, you know, a golden bullet that's always going to... that's always going to prove who did it without a shadow of a doubt. And I can see that definitely the same effect would happen. I mean, our pop culture does affect our views and our societies and all sorts of things. At the same time, I doubt very much if that's the only route of things like this. I think you also have to look at broader backlash against human rights, against the Human Rights Act in this country, and things like that. And also the very totalitarian nature of the way that the anti-torture provisions in international law have always been put. I mean, Article 3 of the European Convention is substantially the same as Article 1 of the UN Convention Against Torture and prohibits any and all torture or inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. So it's quite a broad range of behaviour that's prohibited there. I think for the better, and I think this trend is very worrying, but I'm not at all surprised, and I do think pop culture has played a role.
Okay, Seb.
Yeah, I think pop culture's played a role. I think TV shows such as 24 do, I think, show, partly because obviously they are glamorized versions of have drama, show a clear line between here's torture, here's the information, here's the people saved from the bomb not going off. And obviously, in reality, it's, I presume, anyway, not like that. They don't show, there's no show of a diary of Guantanamo Bay of innocent people getting tortured for no reason for years. And so obviously that's going to fade. And obviously, I think, as David said, it's not just that. I think part of the war on terror and the image of a whole is kind of the other, and this great battle between cultures, it's the West versus radical Islam, and we must do everything possible to win, and therefore doing anything but, you know, ruling out anything is soft and will lose. And that kind of attitude that was kind of promoted by governments to an extent also, I think, contributes it to. But I think certainly shows like 24 do have a role in that.
Joe?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with everyone else, essentially. I mean, I'm no fan of sort of television generally. I think really it's, as you probably gathered from our discussions previously. But yeah, I think it's quite shocking some of the things that can be on. And I think that although whatever it is, 24
yes, 24, yeah. 24 in Homeland.
Not quite up to date.
Named after the number of hours in the day, for those of you at home.
Because he does do a lot in those hours. He's a very busy man.
It may have an effect, but you know, I certainly think there will be other aspects. Now, I think part of that is having a broad and wide sort of public discussion, as it were, and allowing for different streams of influence to come in and affect people. Now, part of that is probably having, you know, more debates. I don't know if anyone at home watches Intelligence Squared, but there's some fantastic debates. And, you know, if you had that sort of thing on the TV, and if you just didn't have this sort of very pop culture fictional notion of torture, and if you sort of open the doors to other perspectives on what such as, you know, a hideous act it is.
Mm. I mean, so does the TV shows have a greater responsibility to try and reduce this sort of thing to basically create a better balance when it comes to scenes of interrogation? David?
Reduction I'm not necessarily in favour of, because then you draw an interesting line between censorship, and especially between self-censorship and between serving the public good. And at the end of the day, if you're doing something like a television show, like a video game, like that, anything of that nature, you are writing to entertain, and you're writing to create this aura of realism within the terms of the television show or whatever. And often that is a big theme that comes up. I mean, not at all within the context of torture, but something that might, I think, contribute to this general idea. I've recently been playing the video game adaptation of the Walking Dead series, both the TV and the comics. And that is a game whose central message essentially is, what do you have to do to survive in terrifying post-apocalyptic zombies, oh my god, circumstances. That's the blurb on the back of the box. But the point is this: we are suffused with this idea that, you know, it's not black and white. There are no rules that survive in all circumstances. Maybe in some certain circumstances. And I dare say the majority of the people who responded to Amnesty's poll in this way, were of that mindset, not necessarily that, you know, let's go out and torture somebody. That'll be fun. That'll be good. But maybe, you know, if 10,000 people's lives are on the line, if it was the only way, that's never going to happen. But if that was the case, then maybe one wrong would be better than a really big wrong. And I can definitely see that being the reasoning of the majority of people.
If you'd like to text in on this issue, you can do so on 07762 212 434, or send us a free web text. Joe?
Yeah, I don't think at all, despite what I've said previously, that it should be a company, a writer, a producer or whatever, self-censorshipping. It should be the state, really. You know, I think that, for one, you know, you're going to affect fiction and drama, and I have seen Homeland, actually, and very much enjoyed it. But, you know, it should be the state's decision. Do you put that on at 10 o'clock, or do you put that on at 6 o'clock? You know, I think it's quite simple, really. But no, I don't think that companies themselves should censorship themselves.
Seb?
Yeah, I'd only say maybe in the interest of providing better television, as I understand 24 has every single time a different method of torture, and then he gets the information. Maybe for Variety, you know, sometimes he tortures and gets it, sometimes he manages it with other means, but in terms of a necessary censorship, I think it's mainly the responsibility of people to have their own ethics and morality and try and not necessarily be dictated by all they watch, and sometimes have a kind of filter and moral filter and say, well, how realistic is that? But I do think David makes a good point, in which case, kind of about consequentialism. How many of those people did think, well, it's technically possible to think of a scenario in which it would be justified, which may never actually, or perhaps will never, exist in reality? And how many of them were actually, we should use, you know, torture in these concrete cases? And so I think for follow-up polls, that would be or through, say, focus groups, that would be a more interesting and deeper discussion to really find out a bit more about that number.
I mean, before we go to David, I just want to ask again, I mean, if it's not TV that's influencing people's perceptions, then what else is? You know, there's obviously the war on terror, there's you know, a multitude of things, but what do you think are the most important influences on people's perceptions of this? David?
I think politics plays a bigger role than perhaps you might expect. I think the discourse about, you know, particularly Article 3, the Human Rights Act, the European Convention on Human Rights, all of that good old Euroscepticism is going to play a role in saying, well, maybe we got the standards wrong, maybe the standard is too harsh. But also, in a sense, just general knowledge about military and sensitive military operations is very low. There was a great independent headline the other day, Britain's wrong about just about everything, which suggests that when you compare the average British voter's opinion about a whole host of different things, and what the statistics say is actually the truth, and I'll put truth in a big inverted commas there because I'm a social scientist, but there's a huge distinction between the facts and the thoughts, and I think that definitely plays into things like this. It plays into the extremification of ideas, and it plays into the extremification of morals, and it does play into that consequentialist rhetoric.
Yeah, I think we can actually go back, you know, very briefly to our previous debate about sort of public culture, what's it for, what sort of virtues and ethics should it put forward. Generally, I'm not entirely sure where it sort of springs from. I certainly think that television and video games or what have you will have a role, but having said that, you know, it's not as though, you know, sort of you've got to ban them or anything. So really, I think it's a difficult issue, and without sort of a concrete idea of where it's coming from, which in any case is going to be really difficult, I think it's a difficult debate to sort of pin down.
Do you think there's any reason that the figures for Britain are higher than, say, in Russia? No?
Not. It,
well, I imagine if there was more research, it maybe would prove me wrong, but I posit that less Britons, or particularly, I mean, there's probably a demographically perhaps technically more likely, but anyway, white Britons who aren't racially profiled as terrorists anyway, probably have less of a fear of actually being tortured themselves, and so and haven't had a history of torture for a very long time, probably see it very much as, what can we do to them? Whereas Russian people are probably slightly more aware of the flip side of the coin, which I think British people don't have, is that it's not just used for you know, good governments against bad terrorists can be used by bad governments against good people, and they're probably more conscious of that.
I think there's also an element of you have to respect the methodological limitations of any study like this.
Yeah.
You know, I know I always sound like the most boring person on the planet right now, but I dare say there's an element of participation bias built into that. The Amnesty is far more likely to get people to respond to it in this country, whereas in Russia it's far more likely that only a certain group of the Russian population is likely to respond to an Amnesty poll of this nature, and they're likely to be towards the left wing of that country and therefore likely to be more straightforwardly opposed to the idea of torture.
I mean, in the report they say they've identified 27 different kinds of torture and other cruel treatments in 79 countries this year, including electric shocks, rape, waterboarding and mock executions. I mean, for the panel, I mean, this is going to be the broad question. Is torture ever justified, or is it always wrong? What do we think, Seb?
Well, to go back to the point, relate to that in the, without the polling, I'd say technically what I said is hypothetically possible, because I'm a consequentialist anyway, I'm a rule utilitarian, so I kind of have to believe consistently that it's theoretically possible to imagine a situation where it is, but I don't believe there's ever has or probably ever will be a situation where in reality it's going to be justified. So for all intents and purposes it's not going to be justified, but that's to be a tiny possibility because of kind of more consistency that it may at some point technically be.
Yeah, wrong. Yeah,
I would tend to agree with Joe. I think whilst I'm not necessarily a political philosophical liberal, that is to say, I don't necessarily believe that it is just individuals with autonomy and the state. And incidentally, that's where the prohibition on torture comes from, is the idea that human beings have dignity and are therefore a cut above, shouldn't be used to be means for ends any more than you would want to be used as a means to an end yourself. But even so, I think it is an important part of our public morals that we need to uphold. It's something that has been a big part of British legislation and British law for a long time. There's a famous 2001 judgment where the House of Lords, as it then was, effectively said, yes, the prohibition on torture is an intrinsic British value. And I agree with that, and I think it's absolute, and I find it profoundly worrying that so many people disagree with me.
Okay, we'll leave that debate there for now. If you'd like to text in on any of the issues we've been discussing, including our final topic, which will be on the Ukraine crisis, the number to do so is 07762 212 434, or you can send us a free web text.
This is URN.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. We'll be talking about the Ukraine crisis, which has been ongoing since we last met before Easter. If you'd like to text in about this, the number to do so is 07762 212 434, or you can send us a free web text. So since we last had our last show, Russia has effectively annexed Crimea, part of the Ukraine, and President Putin of Russia has held a huge parade to mark 69 years since the Soviets defeated the Nazis amid a surge of patriotism over the annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. Recently, 7 soldiers were killed when rebels ambushed and armoured a personnel carrier near the Donetsk region, according to the Defence Ministry. One rebel is also just have died. There's been ongoing violence in the country, and Russian troops have moved to begin constructing a pipeline to supply Crimea with water weeks after Ukraine cut off supplies. It's been an ongoing situation which has developed quite quickly. I mean, what can we say about this? Have sanctions on Russia been effective in de-escalating the conflict? Will they be effective in de-escalating the conflict? The West has tried to target key figures of the of Russia, particularly in the oil industry and those close to Mr. Putin. Will these be effective in the future, Seb?
Well, I think so far, I think it's fair to say they didn't appear to have been successful. The crisis is still ongoing, and although it's not some level, it's not an explicitly Russian troops moving into Ukraine. It's very much Russian special forces, and there's kind of law to them continuing stirring up increasingly serious problems and turmoil in much of eastern Ukraine. So I think at this stage, no, they don't appear to have worked. But then again, the first sanctions were always quite light. And therefore, I think knowing that Putin's perhaps more serious in his plans and more ambitious than perhaps we thought at that stage, I think it is clear that if sanctions are to work, they are going to have to be more significant. But again, as many commentators have said, what's holding back certainly the EU as a whole is, of course, Russian gas. And so if we do get into a sanction war, what happens? What's that do to European economies? And I think that's certainly preying on the minds of officials as when they decide whether or not to engage and impose more sanctions.
David?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think there are a whole host of factors that mean that European and indeed worldwide attention to Ukraine and therefore the success of the sanctions approach are failing. First, that Russia, whilst a fairly unstable economy, particularly at the moment, is still a very large economy and so can absorb quite a lot of those sanctions before there starts to be the sort of real economic impact that's going to force political change. But also that, as Seb says, Europe in particular, who are the main opposition to Russia's policy campaign, I don't say military campaign, in the Ukraine. Also, of course, because there are so many Russian billionaires in the city and we don't want to lose all of their money, so George Osborne is going to oppose any sort of attempts to impose very heavy sanctions that affect the city's ability to trade, which is a word I can't say on radio. And also, finally, of course, that the UN is the UN Security Council has Russia as a permanent member, and therefore the Security Council cannot step in because Russia will simply say, nope, veto, done. There are a whole host of other things. I mean, Syria as well. You might recently have seen the news that the Iranian, I think, foreign minister declared that Iran had won against the US in Syria. That's still bubbling away. People are still dying in the hundreds of thousands. And it is a profoundly unstable time, and the UN model for global governance is spread incredibly thin.
I mean, this has been an extraordinary period. I mean, Russia has annexed Crimea. Many pro-Russian separatists occupy many official buildings across the country in Ukraine. We've had Mr. Putin himself saying, let's delay the referendums that have been proposed in these countries to try and, you know, declare independence from Ukraine. I mean, what is Putin's end game? I mean, what does he want to achieve out of all this? There's been a surge of patriotism for Mother Russia, it seems, as displayed in the parade that was in Crimea, you know, a huge display and condemned by the international community. I mean, what is Putin's end goal here, Joe?
I think broadly a proud Russia. Now, we shouldn't really interpret that too broadly in thinking that he basically wants the Soviet Union back. But I think a common feature of this whole debate has really been the idea of bringing Russian-speaking people back together. And that's what's allowed this sort of dipping into various countries diplomatically from Russia. I think that's a major point. And yeah, I think it's really sort of bringing pride into a coherent nation-state, which is what Putin really wants. But having said that, that's not necessarily Putin being reactionary, necessarily.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, David.
I think Putin also, as an individual figure, wants to be seen as a powerful statesman as an individual. I think it's quite clear that he has some sort of power complex. I don't think it's necessarily going to lead to World War III, but it's clear that there is an element of wanting to be the grandstanding statesman. But I agree that Joe's definitely got an element of it there. It is profoundly disturbing to a certain extent in that the Russian opposition, as I say, to intervention in Syria was very much on the idea of self-determination and all of this. But you must remember that the Ukrainian uprising ousted a president who was very pro-Russia, and also that a lot of people in eastern Ukraine are very pro-Russia. That's not a blanket condition. For instance, a lot of the ethnic Islamic Tatars in the Crimean region very strongly oppose Russian rule. But it is still the case the majority of people there are very pro-Russia and perhaps very anti-Europe. And so the Ukraine finds itself as a unique moment for Russia and for Vladimir Putin to stretch his political muscles.
I think I'd have to broadly agree with you both. I think it is about Russian national identity and kind of constructing a proud Russia, which is kind of powerful and does have more of an empire, not necessarily it's great. Video actually unearthed kind of during the Ukraine crisis of The Simpsons where Russia at the UN flick a button and the Russia placard turns into the USSR again.
That's what we wanted you to think.
And
I don't know why they're German.
All hell breaks loose. I don't know. That was, well, funny and particularly funny when it was brought up again. Not quite to that extreme, but I think it's an interesting parody of it in that there is a sense of the USSR and the pride and the power on the world stage coming. Because I think there was a feeling of a lot of betrayal of Russia and a moment since the end of the Cold War, and wanting to, I think there's a number who do feel they want to relive that. And I think, as David said, I think there's very much a power complex to Putin, and there is populations, Russian loving populations in eastern Ukraine who are strong enough to help facilitate that and create such turmoil.
Just a reminder, if you'd like to text in on this, the number to do so is 07762 212 434. Joe.
Yeah, I was going to say, based on what Seb's just said, which I think was very good, I think what we've got to remember in all of this is that there is a sense of a narrative to all of this. There hasn't been a huge break in Russia's history in the past sort of 100 years or so. I mean, clearly, from 1917 onwards, it's been fairly relatively linear. And from Putin coming in, there's still been an immense amount of pride in to the Russian population towards the Soviet era, you know, despite the torture, despite the gulags, etc., etc. So there's still a pride in that history. I think Putin is really playing on that. And although what I said previously, I don't think it's reactionary, I don't think it's necessarily harking back to that, but I think that the sort of Soviet era as a manifestation of pride, I think, is what is a sort of legitimate model that Putin can use. Mm.
Do you think the conflict in Syria was a catalyst for this? Because it surprised everyone, and you know, that nobody ever expected Crimea to be annexed and for Russia to go as far as it has. What do you think, David?
I would struggle to say there's a direct causative link between the two, but I think Syria demonstrated very effectively that, at least in the short term, the age of humanitarian intervention of the Yugoslavia model is more or less over now. So in the worst possible way, I think Russia is very much trying to see what it can get away with. I mean, from the Russian perspective, the American-led humanitarian intervention of the 1990s and 2000s was little short of cultural imperialism by other means in any event. It was very much about America invading other sovereign nations and flexing its muscles and disobeying international law left, right and centre. And I think there is a sense that maybe it's Russia's turn now, and that Russia is going to step onto the international stage and become that major international player. And again, that hypes up, brings back a lot of nostalgia, I suppose, of the days when Russia was a superpower in the Cold War. No, I don't think it's directly linked, but I think that there might be indirect links buried in there somewhere.
Do you think Putin will increase his clout amongst other nations, or do you think he's just damaging his credibility?
I think it's going to do Russia long-term harm, particularly within the Anglophone sphere and within the West. In terms of the rest of the world, in terms of African nations, in terms of Asian nations, I think they're going to struggle because of the other BRICS, particularly because of China and its increasing role on the global stage. And you have to see a link there as well, that Russia is threatened by China. So there's an element, I think, of Russia being constrained, but also Russia being strangely free and trying to figure out what it can do and where it can explore in that international space.
Seb?
I think Syria was important in this to the extent it was Russia realizing about how far it could go and showing the reluctance, as David said, of, you know, Western countries to intervene to an extent. So I think it gave an indication to Putin of what he could do. I certainly don't think it's kind of the main cause, that without really the very unpredictable set of circumstances that are converged and combined in Ukraine that are happened to what would really have been unthinkable a couple of months ago. So I don't think without that, you know, Syria does it on its own. I think it's, however, important within that, and is kind of a test for Putin and Russia.
What do you think the international community can do to resolve this? I mean, what's the next step that anyone could take apart from sanctions? I mean, there seems to be a civil war erupting in Ukraine gradually. I mean, Joe?
I mean, there's two questions, really. There's what we could do and what we will do. And that's a point that David touched on in particular. In what we could do is enforce far more significant sanctions. What we will do is we won't do that. And I don't think an awful lot will happen. I think, again, agreeing broadly with David, I think it's Putin is, although he won't win, again, it's sort of inverted commas broadly, I think he is going to be able to flex his muscles. I don't think the West, broadly, is going to do an awful lot.
One thing that could be done, which wouldn't necessarily be the best or even the most popular solution, particularly with the Ukrainian interim government, is partition, is to recognize that the West and the East are very strongly divided in terms of being pro-Russia or pro-Europe, and to say we the two halves of the country see themselves going in very different directions in the future, and to recognize that the Western Ukraine is more of a European beast and shouldn't be able to dictate to the Eastern Ukraine that their industry and their cultural links with Russia should be overdone. But I think, again, that's something that's very unlikely to cut much mustard, particularly in the short term. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the long-term solution that we end up with as the conflict boils to a close. But there's very little that we can do. Certainly we can't step up far from sanctions. I mean, from a military standpoint, you can't invade Ukraine because then Russia invades the Ukraine as well properly. And then you have thermonuclear war, and that's not a nice end result for anybody.
No, generally not. No, I don't think it's ever worked in the past.
That's the take-home message from today. Thermonuclear war is bad.
Remember. If you're doing an exam on that, remember. Seb.
Yeah, echoing much of what David said, I think sanctions are really the limit. I mean, it's a question of how far do you go? What, you know, how far will they be effective? And can you go to any significant sanctions without fearing too much of a backlash from Russia in terms of gas? And so in that sense, I really think there will be little done in terms of sanctions. I don't think there'll be a huge significant impact from them because of that. And well, as David said, I don't think you want to, certainly can't invade Ukraine. I think you even want to be cautious about how many war games you have and how many troops you have very close to Russian troops, because ultimately, as we've got to remember, if this goes badly, the end result is thermonuclear war. So you really don't want to take really much, if any, of a gamble on that being the end point.
How far do you think the referendums will go in so much as people will vote for them to try and declare independence from Ukraine? Do you think that will be a sort of bottom-up process, or do you think Putin will try and do it no matter what?
I think it'll definitely be used for PR more than it will support a rebel uprising. I think my sense is that the rebel uprising is as big as it's going to get without support from Russia and support from Russia's international allies. So I think they are broadly a farce, and they're a farce that's been organised by the rebels to give them some sort of sense of legitimacy, but nevertheless, I don't see them being used to create a groundswell of popular support.
And Seb?
I think it'll be broadly similar to how the one in Crimea was used, and one done in very opportune circumstances where really a large portion of the anti-Russian, or at least not very pro-Russian, grade really are intimidated and really can't have any reasonable portion of voting against them, in which case, and also a very much vote-rigging evidence of the one in Crimea. So I think similarly, it'll be a PR kind of thing. They'll say, this is the mandate. And along with, as we've said, the excuse of Russian speakers, it will go be used to pop up the narrative of we've come in here to protect Russian speakers, and look, there are lots of Russian speakers who want to join Russia, and this validates our whole mission. But I think that will be the limit of it.
Right, we're going to have to leave it there. We're almost out of time. Thank you very much to the panellists for coming today. Thank you for listening. Good luck with all your exams and essays.